Right, hello and welcome to another episode of the Long Ball Football Podcast, a weekly podcast by two brothers about all things football in Portugal. You're listening to myself, Albert, and following on from the success of our recent podcast in Barney's absence with guests, it's another fantastic guest-filled show. Firstly, following the success of his debut just a few weeks ago, Andrew Batista is back. Andrew, thanks so much for coming on again. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks for having me.
And we are delighted to be joined once again by Mr. Tom Kunda from Portugal.net. Tom, another rare appearance on the show, but another very welcome one. Thank you for giving us your time.
Well, thanks for asking me on. I always love coming, and talking about Portuguese football, and what better place to do it than the Long Ball Football Podcast?
It's very kind. And well, we'll get stuck straight into it because I know, Tom, you're very keen to talk about Sporting, and I'm sure everyone's aware of your allegiances to Sporting and how keen you are to talk about how well they're playing, which I'm very pleased about because, as Andrew can attest to, I personally am starting to run out of things to say about Sporting. So I'm very pleased to have someone who's enthusiastic to talk about how well they are. Obviously, they started off the weekend with a wonderful result, 3-0 away at Estoril. I believe their third win in a row by a 3-0 margin. So they're making something of a habit of it. Their seventh consecutive win of the season, 21 points, 25 goals scored, still only 2 goals conceded in the whole season. I will, of course, let you kick off, Tom, because you must be absolutely delighted with the way things are going. The thing I'm interested to get your take on is, where do you see them dropping points, if at all, anywhere this season? Because the form that they're in is frightening, is formidable, and it's a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, well, I'll try not to use up my whole, 50-minute allocation of the show talking about Sporting. But yeah, actually, I'm glad just to where you ended that little intro there, Albert. An absolute pleasure to watch, and I think that's the thing which really stands out for me, this Sporting team. I love watching good football. It's not just Sporting. I loved watching, for example, the first Benfica team with Jorge Jesus, that first Benfica incarnation. It's just such good football. I just love watching that team. I love the André Villas-Boas team of Porto. If you love football, you've got to love these teams. And of course, Mourinho's Porto. And of course, the big question now with Sporting is, can they kind of be talked about in the same breath? Because if they keep going on as they are, then, they're really going to be one of the most, talked about teams in recent years, I think, in Portugal. Because just talking with quite a few of my friends here, Sporting friends, and we're all in agreement. This is the best Sporting side I've seen in my lifetime, without a doubt. Wow. I've been living in Portugal for 30 years, and there's no doubt about it. It's really difficult to find any weaknesses, but just, the way Amorim's got them so well organised. One player's injured, another player comes in, knows exactly what to do. They've got, obviously, Vitor Gyökeres is a star player, but, they've got kind of lots of star players and no star players, if you get what I mean. It's a really good unit. It's a really good team unit. And, for instance, the game on Friday, I think, just exemplified that. Some of the slightly lesser, you could say, the slightly more unsung heroes really came to the fore. For me, the man of the match was Mateus Reis, just absolutely superb, both in defence and attack. And it's players like that, I think, which is really the measure of a great manager. When you get kind of your squad players. I always remember Mourinho saying, with some of those squad players of his great Porto side, can you remember that striker, Jan Kalkas? I'm sure Andrew can remember him. And, these players who just came in, maybe they'd only play 5 or 10 matches a season or, just get a lot of substitute appearances. But they come on and they really make a good contribution. And, Mateus Reis was superb. Again, filling in a bit, if Gonçalo Inácio was fully fit, he wouldn't have even been in that lineup. But he was excellent. Morita, what a great player Morita is. Another player who's slightly, an unsung hero. And then, of course, It was very interesting actually going to Estoril because they've actually changed a position where the press box is. And so we were right between kind of the corner flag and the halfway line, which happened to be exactly behind the sporting bench. And I tell you, it was an education, Albert. It was amazing because I felt sorry for Maxi Araújo, who was the new guy, because he was playing on the left, so as a left winger. So he's right in front of Ruben Amorim. And it's amazing, Ruben Amorim. He just kind of was micromanaging him the whole way through that game, pointing, telling him where to go sometimes, correcting his position from like literally it'd be about 4 or 5 meters backwards or forwards. And that kind of attention to detail, I think, just again speaks to really what a classy manager Amorim is. He just seems to know exactly how to motivate his players, how to improve his players, how they fit into the team to make the team a stronger unit. And it's really it's going great guns. The only thing is, I'm a little bit hesitant to answer your question when you say, where can you see them dropping points? Because we've seen this happen in the past, haven't we? We've seen Benfica start seasons fantastically. Looks like they're never going to. I remember even the second Jorge Jesus time he was here, he started one of those seasons really well, and we were all saying, they're just going to win every game in the season. They're going to walk the title, and then it all went pear-shaped. And with Sporting, imagine Gyökeres gets injured, Pedro Gonçalves gets injured, and then all of a sudden we could be, one or two bad results, and it's a different conversation. So yeah, I'll just say it is an absolute pleasure to watch this Sporting team. It's very difficult at this moment to single out any weaknesses, and everything's just going swimmingly. But we're in September, aren't we? We're still in September. The season's
Absolutely.
two months old. And so let's see if we're still having this conversation in 6 months' time. Well, I definitely will waffle on for a whole show.
We'll have to have you as a special guest. We'll give you a 2 hour long platform if that happens. You can come on in. Well, I think it's interesting that you bring up what would happen if they were to lose one of their key players, Pedro Gonçalves or Vitor Gyökeres. One of the few notes that I did make about Sporting this game, because like I said, I find myself repeating myself every podcast about them really. But one of the few things that I took from this game was, well, one, the fact that Vitor Gyökeres didn't score and they were very much still able to win the game. And also the fact that Pedro Gonçalves didn't play, and yet it was still a very convincing performance. So in one aspect, that I think is a good sign for Sporting fans, because it does show that if, perhaps they if they weren't able to rely on Vitor Gyökeres' goals, or if Pedro Gonçalves wasn't available, that kind of thing, that the players that they do have at their availability are still competent enough to do the job. And I think Mateus Reis, who I did see, forgive me, I can't remember who, but I did see somebody on Sporting say he's possibly one of the most underrated players of the Amorim era, because this is a guy that's contributed ever since Amorim's been in charge, and I think that's it's a fair assessment. He's not always been perfect, but certainly his adaptability and the way he's able to play multiple positions has been a real asset over the years. So I think that's
Oh, absolutely. He's got two championship titles under his belt. He could
well,
have a third. How
exactly
many
that.
players in Portugal have three championship titles under their belts? Even
Yeah,
two, not that many.
and just and that little skill for the Jenny goal, that skill he does where he passes the
Yeah,
ball through. I mean,
yeah.
he's one of those players that he can do something like that. And he's a guy that plays in defense, but he's got that sort of something about him that's really, really good. He has a bit of a temper and he's had some issues, but I think that's what makes him really good. It's that sort of passion and, really, really good player.
I completely agree. I wonder, actually, I was going to come on to this point towards the end of the discussion, but I think it might be worth coming on to now, because when I was listening to you talk, Tom, one thing I was interested to get your perspective on was kind of it sounds like a simple question, but where this change in Sporting's fortunes has come from in a wider sense, not just in terms of, oh, well, they brought in Ruben Amorim, but obviously so much was made of the fact that Sporting went 20 years without a title, and I think it's also fair to say that there were very few times when they were close within that period. So it was a long period where Sporting were were out of the title conversation completely. And obviously this change that we've seen since 2019 has been profound, really. And that doesn't come overnight, and it doesn't come from one decision like bringing a new manager in. The reason I wanted to bring this up is because Ruben Amorim actually gave quite an interesting interview after the game. He was actually asked on a slightly different topic. He was asked if he thought that the overall quality of the Portuguese league was going down in terms of the opposition, you know, not in terms of Sporting, but in terms of the teams that they were playing. He gave a really interesting response. I've got his quote written down here because it relates to managers, where he says, there are many clubs that do not make plans with the coaches who are already building their squads during the pre-season. Portuguese coaches suffer a lot when clubs are planning and signing players and they're arriving every week and they don't have 2 weeks to work on the tactical side of the team. And he used Felipe Martins as an example. Felipe Martins, with the quality that he has as a coach, left while the club was constantly looking for players. And on the one hand, I think that's an interesting quote because he's talking about smaller teams who perhaps, you know, we think about the managerial merry-go-round about how clubs are not building their teams around managers, and they're not allow bringing managers in and giving them a long time to build a team. They're not bringing in managers who are given the trust and the responsibility to necessarily sign the players. The reason I think that relates to Amorim is because when I look at Sporting under Amorim, I think that's the complete antithesis, and it shows Sporting, who have really recognized a kind of, not necessarily modern, but I think the way that all the best teams are run today, really, in the world, is you look at it as there's a bigger picture. It's about you bring in a manager and you say, this is the person that we're going to trust, we're going to back, we're going to buy into their system, and we're going to build the squad around what they want to do. And really, that's where Sporting success has come in, because that whole squad is built in Ruben Amorim's image. And I think when you look at the way that Benfica have struggled in recent years, I think it's probably fair to say that they haven't really done that, and they've suffered from it. And then, of course, the smaller teams as well, who aren't able to do that. I'd love both of your thoughts on that kind of idea. Andrew, I'll come to you first. I mean, it's obviously an easy thing to say, but then I guess perhaps on the other hand, you have to say it's difficult for Portuguese clubs to perhaps do that and implement those systems when they're not on at the top of the food chain in terms of sort of European football and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said about sort of finding the right person that's willing to stick it out and is willing to sort of always able to survive long enough for that club to really trust them. Because a lot of these small clubs, they live sort of hand to mouth, you know, season to season. It's quite difficult, the smaller clubs. So that's definitely an issue. I think Ruben Amorim was the real turning point for Sporting because he is a really gifted coach. But Sporting have had to make the right decisions, bring the right players in, sure. But he's definitely the driving force behind that team. I mean, you can see how it's sort of back to what Tom was saying, how every position has two players that can play in that position. And you can see Ruben Amorim, he's really smart. Even in the last couple of games, he's trying to integrate some of the new players in, trying to make sure that those positions are filled. And that's him trying to shore-proof the team. And that's what you have to do because Sporting have had these sort of ups and downs, and now they're finally on and up, and you want to keep that up going. And that's really difficult for other teams to sort of replicate. I mean, we've seen Braga trying to doing it for a while, Vitória for a while. They've been trying, you know, Famalicão on a very slow, steady sort of up every season. But yeah, I think it's literally just that. It's coaches being able to stay in the job long enough. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Stability is the key word, isn't it? It's so important at a football club.
Definitely.
And in Portugal, it's so difficult for all clubs, really. But, you know, for the big clubs, because of course, when their players start impressing, as soon as they start impressing, they're going to be picked off by, you know, one of the bigger leagues. Same with the managers, of course. And yeah, with the smaller clubs, it's even more difficult. You know, as soon as they start doing well, any player really, they're either if they do really well, they're going to go abroad or going to go to one of the big three. Just if they do reasonably well, they're probably going to earn themselves the chance of a contract in somewhere like Turkey or even Cyprus or, you know, Serbia. They go all over the place where they can usually earn a lot more. A lot of it is down to finance, of course, a lot more than they can in Portugal. Yeah, I'm glad you you picked up on that press conference, Albert, because yeah, it was really interesting, wasn't it? What he was saying, what Ruben Amorim was saying, and it's a lot of people are quite concerned in Portugal, and they're saying the gap between the, you know, the big three basically, and I suppose you can then put Braga and Guimarães as a, you know, in their own little band, and the rest does seem to be getting a lot bigger and, you know, worryingly big in some instances. But again, I think that might, like Amorim was saying, you know, players, these smaller clubs, they're kind of receiving players and players are leaving right up until the end of August. And so it does make it really difficult to compete, perhaps, you know, hopefully, and I'm quite sure in, you know, 2 or 3 months, a lot of these teams will, you know, will start looking better and playing better as well and being more competitive because, you know, just what Andrew said and you've said and what I've said, you know, people might think, you know, it's just these clubs just a load of rubbish, you know, they're just going to roll over for the big three. But we saw last season, you know, some of the clubs that in the second half of the season down near the bottom, you know, were playing really good football and causing lots of problems for the big teams. But you know, it takes time, it's stability, really. That is the one commodity which is in very short supply in Portuguese football. And going back to the, you know, to the sporting situation, that is without doubt the number one reason why Sporting you know, where they are now, because it's just been so stable for 5 years now. And the other thing I have to say specifically for why Sporting currently at the top of Portuguese football is that I do think that Porto and Benfica are weaker than they have been in the past, you know, the past 20 years, especially Porto. I mean, look at some of the Porto squads from the past, you know, Hulk. There was a lot of talk also because they're in the Europa League. And so there was quite a lot of reminiscing about that André Villas-Boas team, you know, when they won the Europa League in 2011. And you look at that team and compare it to any team, even Sporting's team now. You know, it had Hulk, you had James Rodriguez, you had João Moutinho, you had Falcão. You know, it was just Otamendi, you know, on pretty much at his peak. It was just an unbelievable team. It was a Champions League team, really, playing in the Europa League. And then Sporting, Benfica, of course, a few years later, and they had, you know, players like David Luiz, Di Maria, of course, was there the first time. Just they, I think the general level, I think, of the top clubs in Portugal, definitely of Benfica and Porto. I'd be interested to hear what Andrew thinks, but I think it's several notches below than it was 5, 10 years ago.
No, I agree. I agree. That's 100% true. I mean, yeah, I think that's why you needed Villas-Boas to come in and shake things up a bit, you know, in the presidency at Porto and Benfica. We know the issues they've been having. I mean, you make a good point about the players going as soon as they're good. You know, if you've been watching this league long enough, which we all have, we have that feeling where we see a player. I had this with Gyökeres a couple games ago. I was watching and I knew this is it. I'm like, this is the last season I'm going to see him. Maybe in
Of
the last,
course.
maybe even the last few months. You know, in January, if a team has the money and they need the goals, they'll come in for him, you know.
I tell you,
And
it's
this is
amazing, Andrew. Yeah, I was amazed that he's still here after that,
yeah,
after what he
yeah.
did last season. I thought there's no way he's going to stay at Sporting this
It
season.
was surprising, yeah. But now you know for sure. Like if he carries on doing this, he's going almost certainly. And I had that feeling with Falcao. I had that, you know, towards the end of Luís Dias' time at Porto. We have this feeling all the time in the Portuguese league, Darwin Núñez, etc., etc. And that's a thing that I think happened less in those days. When we're talking about 2010s, it was happening less. You know, you'd have the odd player, Falcão would go, but then you still had Hulk for a few seasons, and then you could find your next guy, and they were able to replace the players more easily. Whereas now they'll just come in and gut a team. You know, Vitinha, Fabio Vieira leaving in the same window. You know, Taremi, Evan Nilsson leaving in the same window. This is the kind of stuff that happens, and it's difficult to sort of stay on top of that and replace as you go as easily as it was before.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, it's really interesting to hear what you guys are saying. And I think that's, you know, probably why Sporting have had the success they had, because in many ways they've been able to avoid that exodus of key players in the last sort of 5 or 6 years. I was just trying to think as you were speaking, Andrew, which would you say are the kind of the biggest sales that Sporting have made since they won that first league title under Ruben Amorim? And it comes to mind maybe Pedro Porro, maybe Paulinho. I mean, obviously wonderful players, but it wasn't exactly a mass exodus. So they do seem to have been able to kind of avoid core of the team being broken up in a way that perhaps it has been at other clubs
Yeah, that
when
is
they've had
interesting.
success. Yeah, so yeah, it's yeah, it feels like this kind of sports success is I was going to say it feels like a moment, but it's quite a long moment, and I do think it has lasted for quite a few years, and that's why I think it is worth looking at really, because it's not just a flash in the pan. It's not just a case of stumbling upon this perfect set of players and getting this burst of success, and then the bubble bursts and it all goes away. It has been sustained, and they have been able to, a lot of the time, either keep hold of key players or replace the players that they've lost. So it's a very interesting case study, and it is interesting to look at a team because, as you say, I agree completely with both of you about Benfica and Porto looking weaker. And in many ways, I'd kind of thought that in a quite a negative way, that those days were over for the Portuguese league, at least for a while, that we would see a team of that quality again, like that Porto team that you mentioned, that maybe that was just Portugal's place in European football had kind of been diminished somewhat. So it is interesting to see now that in some ways Sporting have been able to kind of replicate that again in this new modern era, which is interesting, although I'm not sure I'd yet go as far as to say, because they've not achieved the same things that André Villas-Boas Porto team or José Mourinho Porto team achieved, but at least it is kind of a team that you feel has a lot of star players that could compete on the world stage. Let's make the jump then to the other side of Lisbon, to Estoril, because I do want to talk about Estoril somewhat, although it is a slightly different story for them. I do kind of wonder whether, although Ruben Amorim used Felipe Martins and Estrella as an example in his post-match quote about these teams who were kind of building outside of the manager, whether he did have in the back of his mind, that Estoril were kind of an example of that as well, because they do certainly seem to be a team. If how can I put it, at the early stages of potential stability, which I think is a diplomatic way to put it, that and they did make an interesting managerial appointment in the summer, and I think that it was an appointment which suggested that this was a team with ambition in a way, because they had Vasco Seabra there, who I thought had done a great job, and they could have absolutely kept him. I'm sure he would have happily stayed. They chose not to do that. They chose to allow him to leave and bring in someone who, I guess, in Ian Catho, that they would have hoped would bring in new ideas and would unlock some kind of something different that will take them to another level. And of course, it is noteworthy that they brought in a manager from outside of Portugal. Definitely suggests that they saw something in him that they hope will grow as the season goes on. That said, I don't think they've shown that quite yet. They've flattered to deceive, in my opinion. I did look at Ian Cathro's comments post game. I have to say, it's the wrong thing to say. I'm very disappointed at how good he is at speaking Portuguese, because I did hope it would be another manager where he would just be speaking in English and I'd be able to understand his post-match press conferences. But alas, he does it in Portuguese. But he did say, he had some complaints about the first goal. It's saying, oh well, that we conceded the first goal when one of our players on the floor. I don't think they can really have any complaints about that. And he did suggest that they improved in the second half, which perhaps they did. But my point is that we're not, there was we didn't see anywhere near enough from them in this game to suggest that they were capable of impacting a game against a club like Sporting. And I don't think we've seen that at any point so far this season, that this is a team yet capable of troubling the league. I'll come to you, Andrew, first on Estoril, just because I think, there is perhaps potential for them to improve, but I'm not filled with confidence when I look at them. I don't necessarily. I mean, they do have one or two interesting players, good players with quality, and they have shown, for example, in last week against Rio Ave, when they came back from 2-0 down, that they're capable of creating chances and scoring goals. But at the moment, I'm not particularly convinced with them, and I don't feel that optimistic.
Yeah, I have to agree. Excuse me, I have to agree. I do think they improved a bit in the second half, but nowhere near enough. They have had some good results. I watched them against Nacional, where they were completely dominated in that game, and they found a way to win it. And I think that's probably how he's going to set up most of the time, is just to sort of set up to frustrate and then try and find something. I'm not quite sure what the idea is there. Against Sporting, it was always going to be difficult, but he's getting results elsewhere. So I think it's one of those things where it's early on. It is still September as well, so we'll see how he's doing by the time we get to Christmas. But yeah, I think it's they haven't been super impressive, but they're getting points on the board, and that's all he's going to care about, and that's all they'll care about really. I don't think it's
Absolutely.
sustainable though. I don't think it's sustainable, but we'll see.
Yeah. Tom, I don't know how much of Estoril you've seen this season, but it was obviously a kind of interesting managerial appointment over the summer. I don't know whether do you think it's whether perhaps Ian Cathro's walked into a tougher job than maybe he expected, perhaps.
I'm not sure. I must admit, I've got a slightly different take to you two on Estoril. I did see their first game of the season against Santa Clara in the stadium. Then I was there on Friday as well, and I think even though they lost, to Sporting, I think there was a vast improvement in their play. They actually played pretty well in the second half. Okay, maybe Sporting took a little bit their foot off the pedal. They've got a Champions League game tomorrow, but they played some nice football in the second half, and they pretty much contained Sporting. Didn't really have many chances at all in the second half, and I thought they improved a lot. And again, we have to remember Estoril last season. They had some fantastic players, didn't they? And they all went, they all left. Rodrigo Gomes, João Marques,
Rafiq
That
Gaitán.
it's Rafika Gaitán, exactly. They, all over the place. They had a really good team. Matheus Fernandes, of course. And they, and so, and even so, we have to remember Vasco Seabra. They did struggle for a lot of last season. They looked like they were kind of flirting with relegation at one stage. And so it was quite a big ask for Ian Cathro to come in against Santa Clara. First game of the season, they were awful, I have to say, absolutely terrible. And then I can't remember their next game again. They didn't improve much, but yeah, I think they've been steadily improving. And I think there's something there. I think I agree with Andrew exactly that. He's probably looked at it now and he's thinking we've just got to get some results on the board. They looked, I think, very well organised in that second half. They looked like they knew what they were going to do, and they've got some decent players. Holsgrove, when he's back, of course, we have to remember also on Friday they had Checa and João Carvalho, two of their most experienced, most important midfielders, were out injured. And so when those two are back, and with Holsgrove, they could have quite an interesting midfield there. So I'm a little bit more optimistic about Estoril, how they might do. Strangely enough, after just being beaten 3-0, than I was before that game. I think they'll be okay this season.
Okay. I feel infused by your positivity, and I think I as a non-Estoril fan, have just my judgment is still clouded by just how profoundly terrible they were in that opening game, which I sat through in full, and I thought these guys are in trouble. But I will make it now my mission to watch their next game in full at the weekend, and I'm sure I'll see some improvement. Let's talk about another game, and we talked about sport for quite a long time. Let's talk about Benfica, because Bruno Lage's start to life at Benfica continued to be a positive one. They brushed past Gil Vicente 5-1, their biggest win of the season so far. Gil Vicente did take the lead, but Benfica quickly turned the game around to win the game beyond any doubt. Tom, look, obviously you've watched Benfica quite a lot this season. I'm intrigued, even in the early stages of Bruno Lage's sitting in charge. Have you seen much how much of a change have you seen in Benfica? Because even just to my eye, they do seem to be playing with a lot more positivity and confidence.
Yeah. I think a lot of it just comes down to the atmosphere around the club, because it just turned completely toxic, hadn't it, really, with Roger Schmidt. It was a big surprise, really, I think, for everybody that he was still, in charge of Benfica at the start of the season. It seems like Rui Costa was possibly the only person in Portugal who thought that was a good idea. Things, the crowd, just the fans had completely turned on him. Of course, there were some quite ugly scenes at the end of last season, and so it's a huge risk, really, keeping him. And then, obviously, first bad results of the season, they just became completely untenable for Schmidt to stay. But some of his decisions throughout most of last season and at the start of this season, really difficult to fathom, just picking the same 11, doing the same things. That what's that definition of madness? Doing the same thing time and again and expecting different outcomes because he just, practically picked the same players, relied on the same players, didn't make any substitutions or made them in like, 88th minute or 89th minute. He had his favourites who he always seemed to pick. And Bruno Lage has come in, he's just shaking things up. He's just put players in the positions, in their logical positions, which doesn't seem to be rocket science. But, obviously he must have had his reasons. Roger Smith, obviously, did brilliantly in his first season, but he just, it was really difficult to understand what was going on at Benfica. I think what most people recognised, even though they struggled at the start of the season, is they've got a fantastic squad. And I think Bruno Lage has just pretty much confirmed that because they've been, pretty good these last four games, I'd say, without really being that cohesive. Of course, he hasn't had much time to do much training because it's been, midweek football since he's been there. And then there was the international break when he came, and then Benfica probably only have about 10 or 15% of their squad at the training centre when it's, the internationals come around. And so, we haven't really seen, his, you can't really say this is the Bruno Lage way of playing yet. I think we might have to wait, a whole month or two before we can really do that. But, you can't argue with the results so far. And I think it's just confirmed what most people thought, that Benfica have a really fantastically assembled squad. Whatever you think about their slightly haywire transfer policy, it has resulted in a very strong squad. And one or two players who seem just almost like they just got them for the because of the opportunity, which was of course the new Turkish guy, who I'm going to completely butcher his name because it's so
I've had a
hard.
go at this, Tom. I think it's Aktürkoğlu.
Good job.
Aktürkoğlu.
Good job. Yeah, he looks great, because of course losing Rafa was a huge, hole that left in that Benfica team, but he just seems to have filled it nicely, same in some ways, same kind of player, lots of pace, but perhaps a bit more of a finisher. Well, Rafa he scored quite a few goals, didn't he? So yeah, they're looking quite good now, Benfica. But I think that if you ask me what the biggest change is between this Lage team and the Schmidt Benfica team, it's just the whole atmosphere around the squad and the fans and the atmosphere in the ground. You can tell it was just, you went there, the dying embers of the Roger Smith, and it was just, there's real tension in the air, and you saw the fans were just kind of waiting for a reason to start booing the team, whereas now it's completely the opposite. Against Santa Clara, against Gil Vicente, both games they went 1-0 down. If that had happened under Roger Schmidt, the crowd would have started going wild. They would have sent flares onto the pitch. There probably would have been an interruption in game. What was their reaction this time? They just got right behind the team, started cheering them, and Benfica, that does make a difference. It's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? 12th man, but
Completely.
if the players feel that the fans are behind them, they're willing them to turn things around, to win the game, to attack the opposition. That's what they do. And so, yeah, it's looking quite good for Benfica. As I say, not playing brilliant football at the moment, but if they keep clocking up the wins, that's going to improve their confidence. And let's see what they're going to be like in a month or two.
Yeah, the one thing I'm always really conscious of trying to avoid on this podcast is falling into the trap of what you see on social media so often with football fans, which is and I do it myself with the team that I support, but it's basically of thinking that you know better than the manager because I'm fully aware that these guys are very high level coaches and players who have an understanding of football that I will never have. So I always try and avoid that. But I completely agree with what you say, Tom, when the solution does just for Benfica it does just seem so simple, which is of not of just playing players in their best position. And it seems like that's been really effective for Bruno Lage so far this season. And I do wonder if it really is as simple as that, which if it is, I think it's doesn't look great for Roger Schmidt, but as you say, he's turned things around really well. And definitely, I mean, from watching this game, the one thing I was thinking of was all of a sudden Benfica's squad does look absolutely fantastic. Like there's so many good players that started in starting 11 and then of course came off from the bench. You know, I mean, we saw likes of Prestiani and Rollheiser and striker his name I forgot, but you know, so many great players coming off the bench. Andrew, obviously last time you came on we spoke about who would be the next Benfica manager. We didn't know for sure, but I think at the time we kind of all felt at least that it would be someone that knew the club, and I think Bruno Lage was even at that point a bit of a favorite candidate. When he was appointed, part of me did think, has he just been brought in because he's a bit of a yes man and he's gonna appease the owners? Of course, that might be very harsh. I'm aware that he's a very high level coach, and he's got at this early stage of the season the team playing well. But now I look at Benfica and I think there's actually another level that they could unlock with the players that they've got available to them, and if they can get, as Tom said, the crowd back on side and get the fans back on side and get the players motivated again. When you look at the squad that they've got with the number of good players, you know, perhaps this was a shrewd appointment after all, because if they can unlock that next level, I do think that is, you know, they can make a real impact on the league.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Bruno Lage is definitely a very good manager. We know that. But I think they needed to sort of appease the fans, which is sort of what we spoke about last time I was on. And they brought someone in that would remind them of a good time, the good time that they did have. You know, he brought João Félix through famously, and that was a good time for football for them and also for money at the end of the João Félix, you know, sort of season. And he was kind of looking for a job, and there's the agent that Bruno Lage is represented by. So he's sort of involved in some of the deals within Benfica now as well. But I do think it's the right appointment because he is playing the kind of football that we know that those fans want to see. Because, yeah, we were talking about, you know, you don't want to feel like you know better than the manager, but being the Benfica manager is the hardest managerial job in the country, without a doubt. And that's why Roger Schmidt found it so hard to sort of bring it back, because once you lose it, with that fan base, it's so difficult to bring it back. But so Bruno Lage has definitely got something going. I will agree that they're not as cohesive as they should be. They let teams play, and in the Gil Vicente game especially, Gil Vicente were really good. They were really, really good. They had more possession. They were really sort of good on the ball, lots of passes, and Benfica sort of dealt with it, and they were able to score, you know, all those goals. Two of the goals were like 90th minute onwards, but they still had to do that against a team that was really threatening them. So yeah, I think the Bruno Lage appointment's working so far, and we'll see in a month's time, like Tom says, if they're sort of playing that football that we think he can get them playing. But I do think even once he sets them up, though, he wants them to play, there'll still be sort of spaces in there because that's how he sets it up. He lets the team, like his opponents, you know, have the ball. I'm also not super convinced by Antonio Silva myself. I know there's a lot of people that really like him, and I think there's sort of a good centre back in there, but he makes quite a few mistakes, and you need him to be a bit better. But Otamendi is still going somehow, and he's still playing really well. And generally, their team's really good. There's guys on the bench we're not too sure of, but they look good. Leandro Barreiro is one of them. I think he's a real sort of gem. But yeah. And just one funny thing about that game, I don't know if you noticed, when Aktürkoğlu scored, you know that the sort of stadium announcer does the, like, he says the number and then they say the name. And they butchered it every time. They didn't get it right once. It was 17 and then a different word every single time. And that was quite funny. I don't know if you guys heard that, but yeah, it really made me chuckle.
Seems like everyone's struggling with that name. Maybe they need to come up with some kind of nickname for him. Poor guy. Let's talk about Gil Vicente, though, because I think you're absolutely spot on to point out how good they were. And I think, you know, they got off to a slightly slow start this season. They didn't get great results in the early games, but they have, I think they've been improving game on game, and especially with players, you know, and we saw the quality that they have in the goal that they scored with Fujimoto, who pulls off a pass that very few players will see, yet alone be able to actually execute. And they were able to score that way, and they have a lot of good quality in the squad, and also a manager in Bruno Pinheiro, who, there was a time when he had a kind of slight reputation around him in Portugal. I think it's kind of easy to forget he spent some time in Qatar, I believe, so he's been away for a little while. But this with so much going on at the beginning of the season, I always find it easy to overlook teams, and it's hard to get your bearings on where different teams are at. But I'm starting to be convinced by Gil Vicente, especially that they have got some quality players and a good manager. And I don't know if either of you agree. I'll start with you, Tom, but whether you think that they're kind of there's the foundations there for, an interesting team and with some good signings and good football, and especially if they're able to make a decent impact against Benfica, then why shouldn't they be able to do the same against teams more around their level?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this game ended 5-1, but it was no way a 5-1 game. That was so, it's just a game where the scoreline didn't match what happened on the pitch at all. Andrew's right. Really, really impressive the way Gil Vicente took the game to Benfica. I'll tell you what really impressed me was the number of players they committed forward, throughout the match, especially the first half. They were coming forward like five, six players. You very rarely see that when a so-called small team, goes to play against Benfica. And they just usually try and hit them on the break. But they were pushing up the field, really good organized football. Fujimoto, oh my God, what a performance. I mean, he's just got better and better season on season. I was looking at his numbers. I didn't memorize them actually, but I think his first season he scored something like 2 goals and maybe 3 or 4 assists. His next season, I think he almost doubled that. And this season, he's started on fire. I think he scored a hat trick, didn't he, the other week? And maybe he scored 2 more. He's got 4 or 5 goals. I don't know, but he was really good this game. There was parts of that first half where he was just like running it. And this is, coming up against players like Cox, who was pretty much a world-class player, and he was just almost running the show. Like you said, that pass for Félix Correa, and he's also a really good player as well. Correa, he caused a lot of problems for Benfica. So yeah, it's unusual, isn't it? Coming out of a game losing 5-1, but a lot of positives. There are a lot of positives for that game, and I agree with you, Bruno Pinheiro. And maybe it's a little bit like we were talking about beforehand, stability. If they can get stability, if they can keep that squad together, because that, can you remember, was it 3 or 4 seasons ago, Albert, where I think it was, I remember you and Barney and talking a lot about that great Gil Vicente side,
I remember very well,
with
yeah.
Samuel Lino, and that was just a brilliant side. And I'm not sure if this side can quite hit those heights. But yeah, if they play like they did against, it was exactly like, can't remember who did the flash interview after the game, but the Gil Vicente player, he said, if we play like we did today, for the rest of the season, we'll win more games than we lose. And that's, 100% correct. They played really well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm aware of us spending a lot of time on two games, so let's keep it moving. Move on to Porto versus Arouca. Porto continue to keep as close to Sporting as they possibly can. They won 4-0. They started to draw against Arouca, although perhaps the game wasn't slightly as straightforward as the scoreline might suggest, especially the first half when Arouca played pretty well to frustrate Porto and try and hurt them on a counter-attack. It was a strategy that worked until Turkish striker Güven Yalcin was sent off. That led to a much more positive second half for Porto, where they got the 4 goals that sort of win the game. Andrew, as the Portista, I'll come to you first. Last week I was praising Porto's newest signing, Samu and Francisco Moura, about the impact that they made. I think I use the phrase the missing pieces of the puzzle, perhaps. I think they both did very well in this game as well. And yeah, I think two subtle additions to the side which make a real difference. And I think they will make a big impact on Porto. And based on the evidence of this game and I think last weekend's game, I think they make Porto a more a complete side, I would say.
Yeah, I think the important thing for Vitor Bruno is to keep on integrating his new signings, making sure they're performing well. Samu, Francisco Moura, and Dennis Gull, who also scored, 2 goals in 2 games for him. And then Fabio Vieira, it's the first time we saw him sort of come on. I think that's sort of what Vitor Bruno is trying to do, is just to see exactly how all these pieces fit together. I think there's a slight imbalance in the midfield that needs to be addressed. They're not sort of creating enough chances through the middle, I think. And Nico Gonzalez is a good player, but he's not like a chance creator. And I think Fabio Vieira will probably fix that a bit. But then who do you lose? Do you lose Vasco Sousa? Do you keep Nico Gonzalez, play him a bit deeper? So that's a question he'll have to answer. But overall, I mean, Francisco Mota has been really good because it's been such a problem position and he has played really well. And Samu, I mean, I think it's four now or five goals. I
Yeah,
can't.
four. Yeah.
Four goals. So good. He's a classic striker. He's up there. He's big. He's always, you know, putting himself about. He's being sort of annoying to the defenders. That's what you need. And he's doing it really well. But you're right about the Arouca game. That first half was difficult. You know, they were set up to sort of frustrate, and they did that. And once the red card happens, then you have to play a whole half, you know, against 11. That's really difficult. And you could see straight away what Vitor Bruno was thinking. He brings on Dennis Gull, changes it to a 4-2-4, and now we're cooking. And that's, you know, the rest of the game. It's just, you know, attack versus defense, pretty much.
Yeah, I did feel a little bit for Arouca manager. I've written down his name this week, Gonzalo Garcia, because I haven't been able to remember it all season. Gonzalo Garcia, he kind of said after the game that the red card changed the game, and they played very well in the first half, which I do completely agree with. Especially as you know they go into this game as the underdog, so they're always going to have to grind out something if they were going to get anything from the game. However, I don't think there can be really any complaints on the sending off itself, which was
No,
pretty
it's
stupid. It wasn't really good enough. Tom, I'm interested to ask you about Porto actually, because obviously you've spent the last few seasons watching Porto with two kind of talismans at the helm in Sergio Conceição and Pinto da Costa. Obviously, it's all changed very quickly. I'm just interested to get your thoughts on how you've seen that transition so far, because I think one thing that maybe me and Andrew discussed before, and I've discussed on recent weeks in the podcast, is that it does seem like that transition has gone fairly well so far, and perhaps there's good performances and the success on the pitch has come quicker than it could have. You know, I think it's important not to underestimate just how big a change it has been, and that really could have been quite destabilizing for Porto. But you know, you see other teams when they lose big talismanic managers and stuff like that take maybe even seasons to recover. So the signs so far are very good, and like I was saying, especially when they got some new signings through the door, it does seem like a lot of those signings are ready to make an impact as well, which is all very positive.
42 years, Albert. That's how long Pinto da Costa was
Of
at the
course,
helm.
yeah, of
So
course.
what a you know, he's, you could argue, is perhaps the most important figure in Portuguese football over the last half
Yeah,
century. You know,
yeah.
you can't
Definitely.
underestimate what impact he had, you know, on the whole of Portuguese football, but Porto especially. You know, he just made that club basically, you know, for all his sins and for all the controversies. You can't argue with the fact that he, you know, he was just a huge, he's synonymous with the club itself. And so it's a massive thing, really, just for him not to be the president anymore. And it's also interesting because it's a completely different style of man of presidency. You know, Andrew Villas-Boas is much more kind of urbane, much less confrontational. He's already brought in all sorts of new kind of, if you're cynical, you might say they're gimmicks. If you're a bit more forward thinking or optimistic, you might say, you know, he's just trying to modernize the club and in some ways it's been quite a nice breath of fresh air, I think, to Portuguese football. One thing, for instance, I've never seen this in Portuguese football. At the end of games, they do a little on-pitch interview, you know, into the microphone in front of the whole crowd, you know, so it was Fabio Vieira. This at the end of 90 minutes, you know, 5, 10 minutes after the game, they hand him the microphone, you know, and he just ask him, you know, how he feels going back to Porto, et cetera, et cetera. So just things like that, you know, I think it's completely changing the whole atmosphere again around Porto, and so it's and of course there was a lot of people, understandably, who were big Pinto da Costa fans right until the end. And so if things didn't start well, you could imagine that could really have caused a lot of problems and quite a lot of friction among the fan base, among, it's quite a delicate time really for Porto. And I agree with you. And yeah, it'd be interesting to hear what Andrew thinks about this point specifically, that it just seems to be very a very smooth transition, much more smooth than I would have thought. Even the playing side, I mean, we all know about Porto's terrible financial situation and the fact they basically can't buy anyone. And especially, of course, at the end of the transfer window, they were expecting to sell Galeno for 50 million, and that fell through at the last minute. So again, I wouldn't be surprised if they really may have to sell one or two players in the January transfer window. But they've found a way to build a strong squad, bringing in some youth players, bringing back Vieira, which I think is an absolute masterstroke. If he can stay injury free, that is going to make such a big difference. You forget how good a player he was because he kind of disappeared a little bit off the radar at Arsenal, didn't he? But he was absolutely magnificent for Porto that season with him and Vitinha, of course. But such a good goal threat in himself, such a, like Andrew was saying, just a creator. That's really perhaps exactly what Porto need, a bit more of a creativity in midfield. So if he has a good season, there's no doubt about it, Porto are going to be really pushing for the title, I think. So basically, to a long-winded way of to answer your question, I've been very surprised, pleasantly surprised by how smooth the transition has been. And it's gone so smooth that people perhaps lose the fact that what a big change, big changes have been made at Porto.
Yeah, that's very much me. Absolutely, yeah, which I think is credit to them. And I'll just end the discussion of this game on one of the more intriguing topics of conversation I saw this week, which is Vitor Bruno's shorts, which he says he will not be changing into the trousers. And I think, as a superstitious fellow superstitious man, I'd say, keep them on as long as you're winning. Let's try and squeeze in a couple more games. So I think there's a couple more interesting games to talk about before we end the episode. And let's touch on Braga versus Real Ave, because it was obviously a big win for Braga against a potentially tricky Real Ave side. They won 4-0. Important for them, I think, to get another consecutive league win after they had that kind of blip of 2 games without a win not that long ago. Also during the week, they played a fairly unconvincing Europa League game against Maccabi Tel Aviv, a pretty remarkable game where they played, I thought, quite poorly and trailed most of the game, and then really bailed themselves out with two miraculous stoppage time goals to actually win the game. But I think the word that has kind of stuck in my mind with Braga recently is unconvincing, since kind of Carlos Carvajal's come in, and I remain unconvinced. Andrew, I wonder how you feel about that, and how you feel about Braga at the moment, especially although after this game, perhaps it will alleviate some of that skepticism.
I mean, Braga for me this season, I've been trying to figure out exactly if they're going to be really good, be bad. It's hard to tell. Carvajal coming back, he had the humility to come back because usually they don't come back. The Portuguese coaches that sort of go off and try and do something else. He's come back to the same team. We know he's a good manager. I think Rio Ave made it easy for them. It was quite a one-sided game. There's some good players on that team. Obviously, we know Ricardo Horta is really good. We know Bruma. We've known them for a while. Ismail Garbi, never heard of him,
My
but
first time watching him as well, yeah.
he really is such an impressive player. He's really good. He got that goal. So there's some good players in there. We know that Rodrigo Zalazar is still around. They've got a pretty good defense. They've got a goalkeeper who I've always had a sort of soft spot for him, even though he's a bit out there in Matheus. But yeah, they're a decent team. I don't think they'll be as good as they were last season. I see a lot of cracks in that team. I think you can see them struggling. They didn't struggle against Rio Ave, but if they get a team like that's sort of halfway decent, or even like Gil Vicente, if they play the way they played against Benfica, I think Braga are really struggling. So yeah, I'm not super convinced. I don't want to be really negative about it, but I don't think that 4-0 win against Rio Ave really tells us much because I don't think Rio Ave are very good in that game.
Yeah, I do still feel like we learned more about them from those games against the likes of Maccabi Tel Aviv and obviously the Midland Derby, which they lost. And so I think there is still issues there. Although, as you say, the emergence of Garbi is fantastic and gives us the mouth-watering prospect of a Braga starting 11 with Gorby and Garbi, which is a
And Gabri.
exactly, which is
Gabri,
quite yeah. I look forward to that.
yeah.
Tom, what do you make of Braga? Because obviously, I mean, I haven't spoken to you since they got rid of Daniel Sousa, which I thought was a you know at the time was seemed like a very bizarre situation. But yeah, again, I mean, what do you make of them this season? Because I feel like we're always waiting for Braga to turn that corner and find that consistency and find that just that cohesiveness, which is going to allow them to kick on to just a slightly different level. And it just always feels like they perhaps taking, two steps forward, one step back, that kind of thing.
Maybe, yeah. I always find it a bit on the Daniel Sousa sacking. I always find it a bit difficult to criticize Antonio Salvador because what he's done at that club has been really
Of
remarkable.
course,
You
yeah, of
know,
course.
for there was a really good tweet. I'm forgetting who originally tweeted it, but your guest last week, Philip Melo, was it? He
Yes,
retweeted
yeah.
it, which was so. The tweet was it showed. The winner of the Portuguese league, if you take out the big three, since 1934, ever since the first one, so it's a really interesting tweet. And so, no Benfica, no Porto, no Sporting. Who finishes? Who wins the league? Because of course we all know only two clubs have actually won the league apart from those three. And for instance, Braga, you saw Braga appeared once or twice, I think, in the 60s and in the 70s, but then in the last 20 years. It's basically Braga every time, you know, and so you really can't just underestimate how he's built up that team, and he's done it really impressively, in my point of view, bit by bit, slowly, 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 incremental improvements, season on season. It seemed a bit of a strange decision, sacking Daniel Sousa, and you had to feel a bit sorry for him, you know, after just one league game, but I wouldn't necessarily say that was a wrong decision. Let's wait and see. As for this current Braga side, yeah, I think they're a bit unbalanced. They've got some great midfielders. You just named quite a lot of them there. And I mean, this Gabri Martinez, who can you remember the game against Moreirense? He scored an absolute stormer and he was brilliant that game. Then he was out of the team. And then Carvalhal, Carlos Carvalhal has really mixed it up almost every game. He's made three or four changes. And so I guess that's him. I don't know if he's trying to send a message out saying you've all got a chance or if it's him trying to work out what his best starting 11 is. The game against Nacional, I also saw last week, which was the first time I'd seen Garbi. He came on, I think it was his debut. For the last 20 minutes, it was nil-nil when he came on. They ended up winning 3-0. He was involved in all three goals. So immediately, you know, you said, wow, this was like an interesting play. And then I didn't actually watch the game yesterday live, but he got man of the match and so scored a goal. So obviously that's quite a player there. I agree with Andrew though. I think it's something not quite right at in that team. I also saw the game in midweek. What a crazy game that was. That could have been like five all. And they were a bit lucky, Braga, really, when they were losing 1-0. Maccabi had two or three absolute gilt-edged chances, which they somehow missed. And then luckily, you know, Braga got a two late goals. I actually think Braga, I think their Achilles heel this season will be their defence, unless they improve it a lot, because it just seems a little bit chaotic. And especially their fullbacks, you know, I've never, to be honest, never been very convinced by Victor Gomez as a defender. He's great going forward, but I don't think he's the best defender. And I think you can say the same about Marin, is it? Yeah, Marin at, on the left back. And I was thinking about this the other day, actually. Braga, they had Francisco Moura. They let him go to Famalicão for almost nothing. Last season they had they didn't he didn't play for Braga, he played for Estoril, but Rodrigo Gomes, who was, you know, you got there two absolutely outstanding wing backs. You think if they managed to keep hold of them two, what a difference that would make to that team. But yeah, I think you know, They've got a good squad. I think Carlos Carvajal, if he can hit on his best 11, get some consistency there, I can't really see any other team challenging them for fourth. I think Vitória, they had a great start, but I still think Braga probably got a stronger squad if they get it together.
So just before we carry on, just a quick question. So I think I don't really like it when a coach comes back to a team. I like that, Carvajal started to come back to Portugal, but I think it sort of shows a lack of ambition. And I don't think Braga lack ambition, but I think going with him again is probably a misstep because I think they could have, especially coming on from Daniel Sousa, they could have done something else. So that's sort of why I'm a bit off Braga this season. So I wonder what you guys think about sort of just the Carvajal appointment itself. What you guys think about that specific decision that they decided to make? Because I thought it was a bit of a strange one for me.
Yeah, I think I've got no inside information on this, but I think from what I've heard that Salvador decided quite soon that Daniel Sousa wasn't the right manager, and so I guess at that time maybe he's scrambling a little bit, seeing who's available. Carlos Carvalho, he was living in Braga. He's from Braga. He's worked for him before. So apparently, also, and it makes sense because of the way it happened. He was sacked on a Sunday. On Monday, Carlos Carvalho was there. Apparently, they said that Antonio Salvador had contacted him to see if he was available. So I think it's a bit more circumstance than actually planned. Yeah, because you make a good point there. It's interesting that he came in, Carvalho. Straight away, he started choosing the players who were there when he was there last time round. So Gorby, who hadn't had a look in then, came straight back in. Roger, who was on the bench, came straight back in the side. And so, it was like really Carlos Carvalho mark too. So yeah, sometimes, we know, haven't we, how many N examples, X examples of managers going back and it never seems to work out very well. So let's wait and see.
Yeah, I remember hearing at the time so many conflicting stories. I wasn't sure which ones to believe. Things about I heard someone suggest that Carvajal was the man that Salvador wanted to bring in originally, but he wasn't available at the time, and so it was kind of an opportunity to bring in the guy who'd already always wanted to bring in. And the fact that Carvajal lives in the area, I find almost amusing that he was, they sacked Daniel Sousa, and it's like, well, Carvajal's next door, let's bring him in. But no, to answer the question seriously, I agree with you, Andrew, that I just don't feel it's a adventurous or what's the right word? I just don't see it as an ambitious appointment, and I do like Carvajal, and I respect a lot what he did at Braga the last time he was there. And I mean, no one will be happier to see him return than Roger Fernandez and these players that he managed last time, because I'm sure they will have nothing but positives to say about him. But I was of the opinion that the Daniel Sousa experiment should have been given more time, and I thought that he was a manager who had real potential. Yeah, I thought it was a shame it didn't work out. But alas, I'm sure Carvajal's very, very happy to be back managing the team that he loves, which is can only be a good thing for him and the fans. Shall we try and do one last game? Because I think there is one more interesting game to discuss, which is Casapia 1, Vitória 1. It does bring us nicely onto the other side of the Mino Derby. More frustration for Vitória, who weren't able to bounce back from that disappointing defeat to Porto the weekend before. They had to settle for the 1-1 draw against Casapia. For Casapia, however, it's another part of what I'm looking at as quite a remarkable turnaround to their season, even in this early stage of the season, which saw them lose their opening three games of the season, and in a manner which I thought was pretty worrying at the time. Since then, they've won two and drawn two games. They now sit eighth in the table. They had to be very resilient in this game as well, because they came under a lot of pressure from Vitória throughout, but they held on for a very valuable point. And perhaps could have even nicked the winner on another day. Tom, I'll come to you. Just considering what a small club this is, with very limited resources, it's obviously a very good result against a tough side. But even looking at the squad that they've got and the manager that they've got and where they've come from, I'm very impressed actually with the last four games that I've seen from them, because to get the results in the manner that they have, I think has been very impressive.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they lost, was it Boavista? Was it that first game of the season when, we all know what a bit of a state Boavista are in, so that really didn't all go well. So yeah, I think most people also thought that, Casapia, they must be one of the smallest clubs, in terms of infrastructures in the league. They don't even play their own stadium, of course. They have to play 80 miles away. And so yeah, it seemed kind of natural that they'd stick around one, two seasons maybe, and then they'd go back down again. But yeah, I agree with you. You have to be, you have to be impressed with the way they've come back. And I have to admit, Albert, I can't say an awful lot about them as a team because I haven't actually watched them this season. I didn't get to see this game either. I was actually watching other games. But yeah, those results, I mean, no one would have guessed they would have got two draws and two wins after their first two games. And so, yeah, hopefully, they can. I'd just love them to stay in the first division long enough so they can play in their own stadium. If they could do that, that would be a triumph.
There's a reason this game is at the end of the running orders, because I don't think there's many people out there watching Casapia games at the weekend. But I mean, I think there are a couple of interesting things to know about Casapia in this game. I mean, obviously the Jose Font was their marquee signing in the summer. He wasn't available in this game. I believe he's injured. But the manager has actually made some interesting decisions. Spanish, I mean, they have a, forgive me, I'm now reading the name out because I can't pronounce it, but they have a Spanish fullback, Gaizka Larrazabal, I believe, who's been another key player, and he was dropped. So the manager's been making big decisions, and these are sort of the team that perhaps will go under the radar, but they seem to be doing some good work down at Casapia, which is good to see. Andrew, one thing I was saying last week was that it's already been quite a long season for Vitória already, when you look at the number of European games they played. And not only a long season, but already a very intense season in terms of every single European game being a very high stakes game. And with even within the league, they've had some fairly big games in terms of playing Braga in the Minho Derby. And even you could say playing Famalicão at a time when there were kind of two teams trying to prove themselves in the league. So a very long season already, perhaps, and a very intense season already. I do wonder perhaps that there's a danger now that we'll start to see them kind of fall short a little bit if they're unable to keep up that intensity, if they're unable to kind of match the early level performance that we've seen at the start of the season, which I think is probably fairly natural because it was a real whirlwind start to the season, and that has gone very well. But I think it's also important to remember perhaps that, this it's not the deepest squad in terms of quality, and there is still a lot to do for that club.
Yeah, and no, I agree. I think we're starting to see that sort of tiredness creep in. There's a lot of games they've played. They're a good team. I like Rui Borges. I think that it's a very good team that he's sort of put together. I wouldn't panic if I was him, not just yet. Two sort of bad results. This is a bad result. It's a draw, but it's a bad result for them.
I agree.
I like how enthusiastic you are about Casapia. I'm not as enthusiastic. I think I've watched them quite a bit, and they are quite a poor team to watch. I was looking sort of at the stats of this game afterwards. 68% completion rate of passing. That's pretty low at this level. But the most important thing is the results. You're right. And if they're getting those, who cares what I say? But in terms of just good football, it is quite hard to watch them sometimes. And Vitória should have done better in this game. Definitely. There's some tiredness. I mean, the goal, Vitória's equalizer, it's a bit of a bumbling goal, kind of, who knows who really hit it in, and it's just like a free kick, kind of a free kick. And then there was that chance right at the end for Casapia. And Vitória sort of looked all over the place. They seemed tired. But I think Rui Borges is good enough to sort of steady this. He'll take his time, he'll try and get the players doing the right things, and they'll be fine. But it is, yeah, it is going to be a consequence of having that thin squad that's probably going to hurt them later in the season because obviously in those places that they're trying to take, Santa Clara's around there. We don't know what's going to happen to Santa Clara if they're going to carry on performing at this level. Famalicão, even though there's a bit of a dip in performance now, they could come back. Braga, so forth and so forth. So yeah, a long season for them is going to be a difficult one. So we'll see what they're made of.
Yeah, also I think that's just also just on Vittorio as well. You know, incredible start really. Had 10 out of 11, was it that he won 10 out of 11 first games, you know, and but you know, losing Jota and then losing Mangas, that's that, you know, that is two big pieces, I think, which you know, you really could in these kind of times, you know, when the squad's getting a bit stretched, when tiredness is coming. You know, if you lose two of your best players like that, I think that's, you know, it's gonna have an effect, isn't it? So it's a bit of a shame that is, because you know, they were looking really, really strong at the start of the season. I still, yeah, I agree with Andrew. I still think they, you know, they will bounce back. It's only what, one or two slightly you know, poorer performances if you look at it, the big picture. You know, if you said at the start of the season, any Vitória fan would have said, yeah, I'll take that for sure, where they are at the moment. So yeah, but I think just losing those two players has slightly taken the edge and maybe slightly taken the enthusiasm, you know, that they could really do something special this season, slightly taken the edge of that, I think.
Absolutely. I'm happy to accept alternate opinions on Kasper. It's fine. You're talking to a man who was raised on lower league English football, so I do tend to get excited about a team grinding out results. What can I say? But I'll always leave it to the end of the podcast, which I think does bring us nicely to the end of the show, gents. I think we'll leave it there. Before we go, just a massive thank you again to both of you for joining me. Of course, as always, if you look at the description of this podcast, there'll be a link to Andrew's Substack and to the Portugal.net website, where Andrew's also a contributor as well as us. So if you want to follow both the guys who've joined me today, all the info will be down there. Andrew, Tom, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll see you both on another episode of the Longball Podcast very soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Albert.
Yeah, thanks, Albert.